Hello, writers and revisers, imagists and fantasists, voyagers and stay-at-homers. I'm Grant Faulkner, Executive Director of NaNoWriMo. And today, my co-host Brooke Warner and I are going to be talking to Hala Aryan about her new novel, Arsonist City. And one of the things that the novel is being lauded for is the way it captures place, specifically Beirut. So I want to focus on the art of capturing place on the page because I think our affinity for different places and the way we experience them can be as deeply a part of ourselves as any person. In fact, some writers capture a place so vividly and forcefully that the place becomes a character in the story itself. So Brooke, I'm curious to start out if you have any books you've loved primarily for the sense of place.
Honestly, so many. And so I'll just give a shout out here to my colleague, Linda Joy Myers, whose memoir is called Song of the Plains. And so the title itself suggests what it is, which is a love letter to the plains. And much of the book takes place in Oklahoma, where she grew up. And this idea of a love letter to place, or like you said, of this concept of place as character, is a great way to think about how to write place. And another author I admire who I've had the pleasure of working with is Natalie Bazile, and she wrote a book called Queen Sugar. And this novel is a deep exploration of place. And she actually teaches on this topic and the importance of place in fiction. And I looked up some of what she has to say. And here's a little quote that says, the relationship that people in Louisiana have to the land is totally different to my experience growing up and living in urban and suburban areas. And then she continues and says, I'd never met people who hunted and fished and literally ate what they caught, like for real. People live their lives according to what season it is. It's duck hunting season, or it's quail season, or it's deer season. It's fascinating to me. And that's what she takes on in her book, you know, this other Louisiana, one she didn't know intimately, but which she delved into deeply in order to write Queen Sugar. And what's cool about place is that you can write what you know, or you can immerse yourself in a place through research and eventually, again, travel so that you can transport yourself and your reader right to that place. And, you know, of course, many readers read books precisely for that reason, to be transported someplace else.
Yeah, definitely. Place has always guided me when I read and when I travel, or when I used to travel, rather. I'd always choose my reading based on where I was going. I'd try to, you know, read about the region or the country or the city I was visiting. And then a lot of my other reading has been determined by where I want to go or wish I could go, which is why I like travel writers. I think your eye is sharpened as a visitor peering into a place that is new to you. And Pico Iyer, who we've had on the show, is a master for capturing telling details. When I first read Pico Iyer's book, Video Night in Kathmandu, it's a collection of essays, I was just swept away. The purpose of the book is to write about how American pop cultural imperialism has influenced the Far East. So the essays are about places with a deep history that are changing dramatically. And this is what's so interesting about the collection, is because, you know, Pico himself is an Indian raised in Britain, and he has just a particularly keen eye and can capture all sorts of cultural dislocations as a result of his travels. And I like Teju Cole's novel, Open City, for similar reasons. He presented New York City as an American Nigerian immigrant, and he titled it Open City because he wanted to focus on New York City's open-heartedness of all things. And the novel is fascinating because much of the action takes place as the main character meanders around town and thinks about what he's seeing. So it's really a novel based on the exploration of a place, which makes it a fascinating kind of, you know, plot line in a way. And then when I was younger, I went to Mexico because I read Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano, and I've always wanted to go to Tangiers since I read Paul Bowles' Sheltering Sky. And one thing I find interesting is that all these books are written by outsiders looking in. So I wonder if there's something about not being from a place that makes you write about a place well. What do you think a writer needs to do to capture place, Brooke?
Yeah, I mean, that will depend, of course, on whether you're writing about a place you know or a place you don't know. I'm thinking about Lisa C. I mean, that's an outsider perspective as well, but we interviewed her too for this podcast. And you'll remember that she'd spent quite a lot of time on the remote Korean island of Jeju to research her novel, The Island of Sea Women. And she spoke to us about being there and feeling the air and tasting the mist and watching the women divers who were the subjects of her novel and all the reading that she did too. So, you know, I think an outsider looking in can bring a really meaningful perspective. All of this is to say, of course, that you can place your fiction in a place that you don't know intimately if you want to, but you also do, of course, have a duty to capture that place well. And if you're writing about a place you know, you might be inclined to think that it's somehow easier, but I don't think it is. And the reason I think that is because I work with a lot of memoirists who often take for granted what they know, and they don't translate what they know onto the page in a way that brings the place, especially sometimes, alive for their readers. So when you're thinking about place, it's about so much more than just what you see, right? It's a full body experience. It's all the senses that you want to give to your reader. So when you're thinking about writing place, you want to think about sensual details. That's really key, you know, so that's going to include obviously like smells and textures and the quality of the light and the weather and the air and all the things that make a place unique, like a train running through the town, or, you know, how the people interact with each other, or the particular history of a place. There's just so much to mine. And it just brings us back to what you said at the outset, Grant, you know, that place is and can be a character. So I'm curious, what kind of advice do you have on this front? I mean, there's just so much to consider.
Yeah, I think capturing a sense of place on the page is super hard. Like you said, Brooke, you need to start with your senses and think about all five senses, not only how you see a place, but how it smells, how it might taste. Because mentioning the food that is typical or unique to a place is one doorway in. And then there are so many ineffable characteristics of a place, you know, the angle of the light, the weight of the air, the way a place opens up into the world or puts up walls, you know, kind of mood, emotional things. And always specificity. A writer needs to provide specific details, not generalizations. But beyond that, I like to think about what the writer Eudora Welty, who so evocatively captured Mississippi, had to say about place. And I'm going to read one quote of hers in particular. She said, "One of the most important things the young writer comes to see for himself is the point of view as an instrument, not an end in itself, that is useful as a glass and not as a mirror to reflect a dear and pensive face. Conscientiously used, point of view will discover, explore, see through. It may sometimes divine in prophecy." And she was saying this in regard to exploring place. And I think this is interesting because the way a character sees a place will determine how it's rendered on the page. So I think it's important to consider that ineffable something that conveys mood and emotion beyond the facts of a place. And I love her phrase that point of view is an instrument to explore and see through, not to reflect or mirror. You know, it's easy to forget the role that point of view plays in capturing place, and that place itself might demand a point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And it makes me think of this new novel that we have on the She Writes list coming out next spring called Speed of Dark, in which Lake Michigan is actually a character. And that's an interesting idea, you know, in an even deeper way to explore place, right? To give an inanimate object an actual point of view, or to consider the question, like, what does the lake think of this place, mm-hmm. you know, or animals, like, what do the birds think of this place? What do they see? And that might shake up your ideas about the place that you're writing about, how you might think of it or write it on the page. And you talking about Eudora Welty in Mississippi made me think of Jesmyn Ward, who's another author who's so attuned to place. And her personal story is quite fascinating because she went back to Mississippi, where she grew up. I mean, she moved home, basically, even though she has a very deep ambivalence about the place. And I was recalling an NPR interview, and she just wrote this thing, I looked it up, that says, there's so much I dislike about this place. I dislike the fact that I have to bear up under the weight of the history of this place, of the history of slavery and Jim Crow and sharecropping, the history of this place that made me. But this is what she writes about. You know, she writes about Mississippi, and effectively and beautifully and brutally so. And I bring this up for our listeners, because it's important, like, you don't have to love the place that you're writing about. You know, it's mm-hmm. good to have conflicting emotions about it and feelings that require a bit of sifting through, just in the way that you don't love everything about your characters, right? Your characters are complicated and place is complicated too.
Yeah, this is making me think, Brooke, that I'm just gonna suggest a writing exercise. A great writing exercise that our listeners might try is to just spend a day trying to notice the place where you live as an outsider might, and then capture it in words.
Yeah, that's a great thing to do, and a way to perhaps notice something about where you live that you might otherwise overlook. And it's so easy, as I said earlier, to take for granted what you know, and especially what we're living in every day, and particularly right now during the pandemic, with so many of us stuck in our places and seeing the same thing over and over again, it can feel hard to infuse newness into any kind of experience. So I think it's great to take a moment and ponder the power our minds have to bring novelty into the monotony of our everyday. And we can do this while we're on the little short break that we'll have, and then we'll be right back with Hala Alian on the other side.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to welcome Hala Alian, who is the author of Arsonist City, which just came out, and Salt Houses, which is the winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize and the Arab American Book Award, as well as four award-winning collections of poetry, most recently the 29th year. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, by the Academy of American Poets, Lit Hub, The New York Times Book Review, and Guernica, and she lives in Brooklyn with her husband, where she works as a clinical psychologist. Welcome, Hala.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Hala, I read that Arsonist City was spawned from a dream you had about an old woman who grew up in Syria and then left to find fame and fortune in Hollywood. And that made me think that sometimes I feel like my dreams are story-worthy in the moment, but then find that I can't really capture them on the page or their intensity fades. But you jotted down 10 pages of notes that led you to Arsonist City. And so I was wondering if you can tell us about how you trusted that dream or why you wanted to follow it into a full-length novel?
That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I particularly resonate with that because I am a pretty active dreamer. And so the truth is I've had many dreams where I've woken up and been like, oh, that's vivid, or that would be like an interesting story, or I like the narrative there. There was something about this that got under my skin. And I think it had to do with the fact that it was like watching a film where I sort of watched this narrative arc of this woman happen from like her being young and throughout the years and moving to California, and just sort of like saw the plot that when I woke up, I felt really lucky. It sort of felt like the plot had kind of already been massaged out in my sleeping state. Salt Houses hadn't come out yet when I had that dream, and I still was working on edits, and then I had like some short story. Like I had other projects I was working on. So I wrote everything down that morning and then really didn't return to it for like a year. I didn't really start writing The Arsonist City in earnest for a while. But when the time came to start thinking about what my next like long form project was going to be, that woman kept like tugging me back. So there was just something about the vividness and kind of the completeness of the narrative and the dream that kept tugging me back to it.
That's fascinating. And I'm not a person who remembers my dreams very much. So I also want to say I'm kind of jealous because I wonder about how that unfolds.
Not usual. It's not typical. It was unusual enough that I think that's actually part of what gripped me and what made me keep coming back to it was I was like, there's no way I just dreamt a plot. Does that happen?
Right. And clearly it did, which is so cool. And I wanted to ask you about place, you know, that in this novel, it's about place as much as it is about the characters. And you said that Arsonist City is a love letter to Beirut, where you lived from 2000 to 2006, and you rendered it in very detailed and evocative fashion. So how was your writing guided by Beirut?
So actually, I was in Beirut for 8 years until 2008.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I did my undergrad the last 4 years I was there at the American University. And I think it's just a place that like I talk about like something you can't shake. Like it's a place that has stayed with me deeply ever since I left. And part of that has to do with the fact that I continued going back. So every year I've gone back like once or twice since I've left for the most part. I guess last year I didn't go. But there is something about that city and all of the contradictions it contains and all of the different ecosystem, like kind of social ecosystems and worlds and like subcultures that it contains and history. It's a really it's a really interesting combination of a place that feels like too heavy for its size, and almost like too heavy for its own shoulders. And also it has a buoyancy and like a, there is something really life affirming and vibrant about it. It is a place that kind of chooses life over and over and over again, despite all of the death and destruction and despair that its history contains. And yeah, I just, it's a place that I continue to, I think, grapple with like my relationship with and what I'm, you know, where I stand vis-a-vis Beirut, because at the end of the day, I'm not Lebanese. Technically I'm Palestinian. Palestinians also have kind of like a fraught relationship in some ways vis-a-vis Lebanon, because of the civil war and things like that. So it just is in a lot of ways, like it was easy to write it as a character because I very much think of it as like an entity. Like it feels like a whole, I'm trying to think of the word, like it kind of is a character for me. It sort of is like a person in my life.
That's so interesting. And that, I mean, Brooke and I have been talking about place as a lead into this interview, because we were so struck by place in your novel, and thinking about the creative process involved in writing about place. And I always remember this quote from Ernest Hemingway, who said that living far away from a place enhanced his ability to write about it. And so I didn't know that you went back so frequently to Beirut, but I'm also kind of curious about that too. Like, did you find that living in New York at a remove from the cities in the novel helped you write about them? And how did it help?
1,000%. Yes. I think it helped in that so I was going back twice a year, the first few years I left, like the first few years after I left. And then I found a partner. I started like the first few years that I was here, I was doing grad school. So I sort of was on an academic schedule. I had my summers off, I had my winters off. And so I kind of like my January off, and I could afford that sort of travel in terms of time. And then once I, you know, got full-time work, et cetera, it just, my life more and more started to kind of pull me towards like Brooklyn, New York, like this is where I am. And so it became like max, I would go back once a year. And instead of going for an entire summer, I go back for like 2 weeks or a week or something. And I think what happened in the last few years, especially over the time that I was writing this, was that there has been a pretty pronounced sense of longing and homesickness for Beirut. And like, it occupies a pretty significant amount of my like emotional reserves in terms of a place that I think about often and ache for when I'm, particularly if I'm down or sad or whatever, like that's where I think of when I think of comfort, because of the things that I associate with it. My, you know, my grandmother and my, the years that we spent there, my parents' apartment, et cetera. So I think there's something in the longing that made it in some ways like really an urgent and pressing place for me to be playing within the fiction.
Well, an Arsonist City is also an examination of what it's like to be a migrant, right? To feel familiarity with many places rather than an assured connection to one place in particular. And in your book, the Nasser children never feel entirely American, even though they were born in the U.S. and they feel like Westerners when they're in Beirut. And so I'm assuming you can relate to that experience a bit. I'm wondering if you could talk about the layering of identity or the split identity that you explore.
Yeah, totally. I can definitely resonate with it. And I think that it's one of those things where I'm really interested in like these emotional borderlands, these ways in which we are both like, you know, these ways in which we occupy two identities and also neither identity, and how the kind of the tension between that often exists between two identities ends up creating this whole third new space that becomes the marker of who you are. So you kind of identify yourself in some ways, not just by what you are, but also by what you're not. And I think that's very true for a lot of people that are in diasporic communities, for a lot of people that kind of have those hyphenated bicultural identities. I'm also just interested in like code switching, you know, like this, like literally linguistically, that's like where the term comes from. But I think also just emotionally, this idea that like, you know, you see these characters when they're in Lebanon, there are different traits of them that come up. There are different like personality aspect, like, you know, personality traits and parts of themselves that come to life in Lebanon that aren't there when they're in their home cities, and vice versa. And that's something I really resonate with. Like I definitely feel like there are different parts of my identity and personality that are cultivated and woken up in different places.
That's so interesting, Hala. And, you know, your first novel, Salt Houses, was written as a series of vignettes, but I read that you heavily storyboarded Arsonist City with the plot entirely worked out in advance. And I'm just curious about that approach as a writer. Is there a reason that Arsonist City demanded to be more, have a more structured approach than Salt Houses?
You know, not necessarily. I think it's more that I just found it to be such misery to edit Salt Houses because I wrote it so according to curiosity, which I think was like, I love that quote of like, the best way to learn how to write a novel is to write one. And Salt Houses was the first thing I'd ever written that was longer form. And so I learned a lot about writing a novel and writing it. And one of the things that I learned was that you need some degree of structure. And the way that I did it was I just followed my curiosity. I wrote scenes out of order. I had like a bajillion Microsoft Word documents that then I had to sift through to create the larger narrative. So in some ways it was just me overcorrecting from the hellscape that was editing Salt Houses. Like I was just like, I'm never doing this to myself again. I want to write chronologically, or at least chronologically according to the events of the novel. I want to have a really strong sense of what's going to happen. And I was worried that that would take some of the spontaneity of the write, because I really like being surprised by fiction. I like having a direction and then writing and being like, well, this wasn't supposed to happen. But I found that the characters misbehaved regardless. You know what I mean? So I had ideas of narratives and then like I started writing them down and was like, oh, never mind. This is like, there's still something magical in that the characters sort of do their own thing and things don't play out the way that you expected them to. So I didn't lose that spontaneity, but it was really nice to have like a solid frame I could go back to where I like at the very least knew what was happening where and at what time with which character.
I find that really fascinating because it's almost like this, it reminds me of relationships, you know, like you have one kind of relationship and then your next relationship is like a reaction against that relationship. Totally. You know?
Yes. Headstrong flings with Salt Houses. Right. And I was like, I need something stable. I need something solid. I want to be able to rely on this story.
Yeah. I love the metaphor. Well, and your day job is as a clinical psychologist. So I'd love to know how that informs your writing since you're thinking about human behavior all day, not just in terms of characterization on the page, but being out there in the world with people. So how does that intersect with your writing?
Yeah. I mean, I think heavily. I mean, I think there's things that you learn how to do as a therapist that are really useful as a writer, not the least of which is just paying attention, you know, like learning how to harness your attention is a really important skill set as a clinician. And frankly, even as a teacher as well, like as a teacher, like knowing how to use your attention as like one of your, I think really like one of the biggest tools that we have. And then you apply that to writing and suddenly you're paying attention to the world and you're curious about the world in a way that I think contributes to more realistic plots and more realistic character development. I also always think about how like therapy is like someone comes in with like a lot of like puzzle pieces. Like there's a lot of fragments. They like, you know, they're coming in with a story that's really disjointed. And part of what you're helping them do as a clinician is helping them like make some sort of coherent narrative out of it. Very similar to a novel, very similar to, you know, it's like you have these ideas. I like this ending. I want this character. I'd like it to take place here. Like you sort of have these, a lot of fragmentation, and then you're trying to find something coherent out of that. So yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap.
I love that paying attention. And in closing, you know, you're also a poet, which is about paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I want to guide listeners to your poem Spoiler, which was recently published in The New Yorker. And we have a running theme in this show of talking about how important it is to read and write poetry as a prose writer. So I'm curious, how does your poetry nourish your prose or vice versa?
I think, you know, I remember, I said this like a million times when Salt Houses came out, where I was like, Salt Houses for me was like writing a bunch of like just like 1,000 little poems over and over and over again. And I really like, I had to get really granular because the idea of a novel was terrifying to me. Like the idea, it felt really insurmountable to say I'm working on something that long. And then ironically, I ended up like, I write really long stories. Like everything that you see of mine is cut like by like 7 chapters before it gets in your hands. So it's funny, like actually I have no problem with length, but in the beginning of a project, it's really overwhelming, the concept of that. And so with Salt Houses, I really thought of it as like, you're just going It's very, if you've read like Anne Lamott's like Bird by Bird, like it's very like you're just working on this scene, you're working on this piece of dialogue, you're working on this description. And in that way, that was very poetry based, you know, it felt very similar to poetry, which is, for at least for the kind of poetry that I read and or that I write and that I like to read, it's often like someone, things are really granular and someone is honing in on a particular moment or a particular insight or a particular experience. And so I just kind of generalized that concept and was like, well, we're just going to do that over and over and over again. And then like, you're going to have a larger piece at the end of it. And I think that's very similar to what I did with The Arsonicity, in the sense of like, when I would feel overwhelmed because it's a lot of characters and they're really like intertwined. There's a lot going on. It would just be like, well, all you have to do today is just hone in on this character as she's having this conversation, or this character as he's doing this thing, you know? And I think that really was like a poetry based thing.
Very interesting. We love the idea of breaking a huge project down into small pieces. That's advice that we often give, but it's nice that you think of it. It's almost like you're thinking of it not as just small pieces, though. It's almost like stanzas of a poem or a part of a poem.
Yeah. I mean, I think I err on this side. Like I'm coded to write really like descriptive, almost like flowery language. So there is a ton of editing in fiction that doesn't necessarily happen in poetry, but I've kind of stopped trying to fight my nature. I'm like, this is what I do. I write really wordy first drafts and then I cut and it's fine.
That's great advice. Thank you so much for joining us, Hala.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back with today's book talk.
Welcome back for this week's book pick. Since we're talking about place, and since I mentioned Teju Cole's Open City, I just want to talk about it a bit more because it is one of my favorite novels of the last 10 years. I've read it 3 times, in fact, and oftentimes just page through it and read selections. And one thing I like about it is how it breaks an old writing rule, which is that you're supposedly never supposed to have a character just walking around town without an identifiable conflict guiding the narrative. And I understand that rule, and it's a good rule to think about because conflict is very important to a good story, and usually conflict is the one big thing to think about. But in Open City, Teju Cole somehow pulls off having his main character, a Nigerian-American immigrant, walk around New York and meet a range of people, many of them immigrants, and hear their stories. So his random wanderings, his experience of the city, becomes the storyline unto itself. It's a storyline of search and witness, I guess, and encounters. And it becomes a type of meditation on place and on uprootedness, home, transience, and movement. And it's also about the destruction of place, because 9/11 has a role in the story as well. And in fact, the narrator uncovers many things about New York City that are no longer present. You know, it's as if the novel is an archaeological dig at some points. You get this feeling of how a place is a layered place of change, how it's always tenuous, never one thing, never entirely stable. You know, one group of immigrants replacing another group of immigrants in a neighborhood. So this is all to say, it's just a kind of fascinating reading experience because it's a different reading experience and because Teju Cole is such a fine writer. And it's one of the great books about New York City in my mind, but it's about much more than that, of course.
Great, Grant. Thank you for that. And so fun to think about what might be your favorite novel about place and maybe find a new novel that's specific to place because it is a world unto itself. And we, too, are a world unto ourselves here at Right Minded. We're a weekly podcast. We're super grateful for your listenership. Thank you. You can download us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And maybe the favor you could do us this week is just to tell a writing friend that we're out here. And we'll see you next week. Thanks again.